Welcome, everyone. Episode 455 of the NBA podcast. As we said last time, we have a very special episode for you today, so we're going to just get right into it. Before we do, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews, and we're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is my very trusty co-host, Morten Jensen. How's it going, Mort?
It's going well, Brian, but you know what? I am not the person you should be focusing on right now because we have a tremendous guest on hand tonight, Miron Fader from The Ringer. Brian, I mean, come on. This is a high for this podcast.
Like I think this is the first time we've had a New York Times bestselling author on. So Miron, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. How are you?
Oh my gosh. Hi guys. I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. It's just been so crazy, but yeah, I'm so happy to be here and talk with you.
Yeah, we are excited to delve into, you are obviously the author of a new book. It came out earlier this month, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. So before we get in, can you let our listeners know where they can buy your book and where they can follow you on Twitter and find your other work?
Yeah, it's available everywhere books are sold. I know Amazon just restocked, so if you're getting a message, it will literally be up in a couple days. But any independent bookstores, some I recommend in LA where I am, which we have signed books you can order, Romans, Chevaliers, and Skylight. And if you want to do audiobooks, that's everywhere as well. Yeah, and you can just find me on my Twitter, Miron Fader, MirinFader, if you would like some nerdy writing quotes. That's about it.
Well, Miron, you are the queen of good timing with this book coming out fresh off, obviously, Giannis's championship run. But, you know, when you were writing this book, you obviously didn't know how the playoffs were going to culminate. So what was the inspiration to go into Giannis and his rise from, you know, going this unknown prospect from Greece into two-time NBA MVP superstar?
Yeah, I mean, I used to work at Bleacher Report, and I did this story on Giannis and his youngest brother, Alex, and I spent the day with them and their family in their home. And, you know, I just felt like, wow, this story originally on Alex actually revealed a whole lot more about Giannis. And, you know, there's so many compelling human interest things about Giannis and his story that I felt like had been unexplored. And, you know, I've been wanting to write a book for a long time, and I just felt like, wow, how is this guy on the verge of superstardom, but we know next to nothing about his childhood? I felt like there was a really big void between sold trinkets on the street and NBA MVP. And so for me, I just got really excited, like, wow, there's so much room to explore. So that's kind of how it all started.
Yeah. And I mean, I did not know much about his background. I mean, the 60 Minutes thing from a couple of years ago, I feel like was everyone's kind of first look nationally at where he came from. But I think one of the best things about your book, and I know Mort agrees with this, is kind of going into that, his childhood and just how, you know, how much his family had to struggle in Greece, as you said, selling trinkets and like being evicted from their apartment over and over again, not knowing if they were going to have enough food on the table. So how much of that did you know going into the process of writing this book? And then how much, as you were doing your reporting process, did you, you know, realize the depths of their early despair?
To be honest, I really didn't know much. I really only knew the broad outline. Really, it was distilled to sold trinkets on the street. And I just had a billion questions, like what street, where, what'd you sell, how, what money, what did you get, what did you eat, like, where'd you go? Like, I just had so many questions, and they just kept blooming into a million more. I think I had no idea that there was this neo-Nazi criminal organization, Golden Dawn, that was patrolling these neighborhoods. I had no idea the struggle of being undocumented and the racism that he faced. You know, I just think that entire time period was a big question mark for me. And so the other thing I discovered too was, like, for as much trauma as there was also so much happiness and love and laughter and light. And yeah, so I just tried to really show all the angles of childhood.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask, because I know you did most of the reporting, you know, during the pandemic, which could not have been easy. So how how did that impact your writing process? Like, was it harder to, you know, gather some of the small details that you do when you're face to face with someone or like can go walk in the same environments as them?
It was so hard. And I think I should just preface and say, like, my difficult pandemic is nothing compared to people that lost their homes, livelihoods and jobs and lives, literally lives. So just want to say that. But from a personal standpoint, yes, it was so hard. I'm so used to like being in a place with somebody and being, you know, in the setting and describing every little detail that I see. And this was like recreating a city that you can't go to. So I was supposed to go to Athens and I had to cancel the trip. And so it really caused me to be even more relentless in my reporting than normal. Like, you know, I always ask a billion questions. What color was the car? How did he get here? What was the street name? But this was like, look, I can't be there. Can you paint the scene for me? Can you help me understand? And just doubling down on vetting sources and talking to so many people in the neighborhood and Greek journalists. So on the one hand, it just made it really hard because I just wasn't used to it. But on the other hand, I was getting a lot of practice. You know, at the time I was still with Bleacher and I had to do all my features from home anyways. So I just said to myself, look, writers write. You got to find a way to do this. The book is due in a year. They don't care that it's a pandemic. They're not like, wow, Miren, I know things are so hard in this pandemic. We'll give you more time. And I was like, okay, well, I got to find a way.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I like having, you know, you have this, I think it was in the acknowledgement section at the end where you note kind of the process of this. And I was blown away because the detail in which you describe some of these environments, especially from Greece, it felt like you had lived there for years at that.
Wow, you know, it was like, thank you.
I just could not believe that you did most of this from Zoom. But I thought it was really interesting that, you know, I know, especially from your time at BR, that, you know, when you went the LaMelo feature, which, you know, you got so widely praised for, like you spent so much time with him that right. I thought this must have been such a big departure from your normal process.
It really is. The whole thing was a departure. I mean, normally I do all my reporting first and then I write. That's just how I work. But this, my publisher had me doing 20,000 words a month deadline. So I had to like actually report and write at the same time. And that's really hard to do in a book because you're looking for a way to organize essentially 15 chapters. And how do you know where to put things when you haven't even finished your reporting? So, you know, that coupled with the fact that normally authors get 2 years, I only had 1 year because we didn't know whether Giannis was going to stay in Milwaukee or not. So I think the whole thing was just a new process for me, but it was also exciting because I think long form is the best preparation for this. You know, I wanted to do this for a really long time, but you grow some new muscles when you're challenged, you know?
As Giannis can attest, I'm sure.
Yes.
Right. Exactly.
Mort, I don't want to hog all the questions here because I know you were blown away, especially by those early chapters that go into his childhood. Yeah. So fire away with those.
Yes, I've been waiting so much, so long for this because I was completely blown away just reading about, you know, not just the complication of his childhood being poor and not being able to eat. And I won't spoil too much, hopefully, but rest assured, like, He was desperate. He was poor. The entire family was poor. And as a parent, that's what got me the most, you know, knowing that, see, I'm getting emotional. I told you even before we started playing, I'm getting emotional because the thing is, like, I can't help but think of my kids and imagining, you know, that they go to bed at night hungry, that they're sitting on a bench looking at a teammate, you know, eating a snack. And I'm completely fixated on the snack that is being eaten. I felt that to my core, and I'm so impressed that you just went through all that and wrote it in the way that you did, because I think it's, you towed a line that was so valuable in the sense that so many people in the world would say, how can you allow your kids to go to bed, you know, hungry? But that was never the main issue there, because they were doing everything in their power, everything that they could possibly do to keep these kids alive, frankly. And I'm so overwhelmed with emotion just thinking of those parents and thinking of what they had to go through, thinking of them having to go to bed every single night knowing I could not feed my kids today. And oh my God, just the tragedy of it, it sticks with me. So my question to you, Mirren, is how did you, I mean, listening to all this writing about it, like going into the depths of it, like how did you keep that at bay? Because I'm sure that also hit you inside as well.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. It definitely hit me in the same way. But I think that I was really concerned about, you know, how to present trauma, because there is also a tendency sometimes in media to overemphasize the trauma, and it's almost like trauma porn, you know? And so how can I tell the truth of this really despairing situation, which is deeply traumatic, without exploiting these parts as well, you know? And I think that was really, I was really nervous about that, because I think with Giannis's story, there's such an inspirational element in terms of how he goes from what you just described to the way he is now. And it really kind of glosses over these really hard moments and kind of Disney-fies them. And so for me, it was like, I had a rule: for every difficult moment of hunger that you see, you have to see a moment of love and lightness. For every moment of tears, there's got to be laughter and joking and happiness. And so I think for me, it was such a balance, and not because I was like trying to put this framework on it, but that was his reality. You know, it's like things were really hard, but then they were also really happy. It's this very, you know, realistic dynamic. I think people who haven't been in these circumstances might not understand that. They're like, well, how can you be happy if you're going home hungry? And it's like, well, he's not happy, but this is his life, and he doesn't have any other framework to go by. So yeah, he's going to have fun with his brothers and not think this is abnormal, you know? And so I just think it was both deeply hard and deeply happy, and these things can coexist at the same time.
Well, I think you did just such a great job at leveraging that, because I mean, you see me, I'm sitting here, I'm a mess, but at the same time, I felt that as well. Like the camaraderie between the brothers there, and just the support, the level of support, the fact that, again, I don't want to spoil too much, but Giannis just taking Alex under his wing to the extent that he did, just saying, no, you know, there is no way in hell that I'm not going to get you to the place that you want to go. Regardless of these challenges that lies ahead, I am going to see you through this, because I have a responsibility. And he did that at age 13 or something, where along those lines. So, I mean, I'm impressed with just how the mindset of Giannis and his brothers and his parents, but I'm also very impressed with how you succeed in leveraging that whole story and do so in a very realistic and layered pattern. So thank you for giving me that experience.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, you could tell, you know, the love between the brothers comes through just loud and clear throughout the book, and between, you know, his parents and the brother, like the family ties. I don't think, you know, you do such a good job with this, just with all of your work, you know, like the humanizing these guys. Like, we just tend to think of them as, okay, this is Giannis, this Grecian god. Like, we don't think about not only everything that he goes through, but everything that's so important to him. And you provide this side that's like, oh, okay, this guy, like, all he wants to do is just like hang out with his brothers all the time. He wants to hoop and he wants to hang out with his brothers, and he's happy with that. But then the community as well, it's really, it's so cool to see, you know, especially given the concerns that you brought up in Greece with the racism and the, you know, especially for an immigrant, and then having his teammates come over and be willing to give him food, or, you know, invite him over to a house for dinner, or people in the local community who are just trying to help them out however they can, the coaches as well. You know, throughout your reporting process, were you surprised by kind of how many people rallied around the Antetokounmpo family, given the larger, you know, problems throughout Greece?
In a way, yes. In a way, no. You're right. Like, it's a community story. It is also a family story, in addition to just being a Giannis story. And you can't talk about him without them and all the people that have, you know, it really did take a village in so many different geographical locations, whether he's growing up or in Milwaukee. But I think that is one of the things I did know going in, that because of the inspirational element, people really highlight all the people that helped him. But I guess I didn't know that there were so many people that did not help him and that were not kind to him. So I think that that learning both are true at the same time. That was interesting to me, you know, like Spyros Veliannatis, for example, the man that discovered Giannis, he's very much been deified as like the man who discovered him and wow. And, you know, the book reveals that there's actually a huge rift between him and the family because he wants to get paid. So I think it was just, it was, again, it's like holding both of these things at hand. Like there were so many white Greeks that were kind to Giannis and helped him and treated with him with dignity and respect. And then there was just a lot of others that did not, that didn't see him as Greek, that only saw him as Black.
Yeah. It's wild, especially as you get later and later in the book, you realize some of these problems have still persisted, even after he goes from, you know, like when he is unknown gangly prospect Giannis, it's one thing, but you know, he is superstar MVP, you know, $200 million man Giannis now. And we're still seeing signs where, you know, some Greeks just do not embrace him as being truly Greek, quote unquote. Or, you know, there is the mural that gets defaced with swastikas because,
right,
you know, they perceive slights against his Greek roots.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Did I interrupt you?
No. I was just going to say, you know, do you think based on, you know, how you spoke, how many people you spoke with throughout the story, like, do you think anything's going to change at this point? Or is this just going to be, he has to live with kind of both of these sides where he knows, you know, more and more of Greece has become enamored with him, but there is always going to be this side of the country that just will not accept him no matter what.
Yeah, I think it, I mean, I'm not sure, obviously, but I do think this is kind of going to be the reality, because if anything, Europe as a whole is moving further right. The rise of the alt-right, whether it's France or, you know, the UK or Greece, like these are, it's definitely not trending in the direction of progressivism, that's for sure. And Giannis could not possibly represent his home country better. I mean, he is just an extraordinary ambassador and person and player, and he is at the pinnacle of whatever he is to achieve from here on out. And if at this point in time, they still are racist towards him, I mean, that is what it is. I think because his story is so inspirational, people gloss over the fact about that. And certainly many Greeks deny their racism. Somebody on Twitter, you know, you can translate tweets. Somebody wrote in Greek, like, why are you putting politics into this book? You know, just write about Giannis. And, you know, typical, like we see that all the time in America. But it's like, no, you cannot write a book about Giannis without delving into the politics, because it influences everything. The way that he is treated, the way he is viewed, the way that he sees them, and you know, it's all related.
Yeah,
and for Giannis to actually embrace Greece the way that he has, that to me was very surprising on one hand, and then on another hand, it just seems like that's in his personality as well, to just ignore the bad stuff and focus on the positive sides, which is why he is proud to be Greek, even though, you know, I don't think anyone would really blame him if he was kind of to pivot away from that and say, you know what, you never had my back. You called me a whole bunch of names. You did all these horrible things. I'm moving in a different direction. But instead, he's still embracing, you know, where he comes from, where he was born, his home country. That to me also just shows a lot of who he is as a person.
And it's really genuine. You know, when he says, I love Greece, like he really does. Like, I think it's very hard for people to hold both of these things in their heads at once, that he can love a country that has not always loved him, that doesn't love him in a lot of ways. because he knows how many Greeks did love him and treat him with respect. And he still is very, very close with a lot of these guys that I interviewed from childhood. And I think that did surprise me in terms of like, God, I was trying to put myself in his shoes. You know, I would be so angry and so bitter at this, you know, government that dragged its feet on granting me citizenship, only gave it to me because I was right on the brink of going to America to play basketball, you know. But Giannis is just a different human being. You know, he is very, very grateful and, but also sees the reality of the situation too. You know, I think the book charts how he is progressively getting a bit more vocal in terms of speaking up about his experiences, being a person of color in Greece and the racism and themes of immigration. And, but he has seen the backlash for speaking up about that as well. So, you know, I it's complicated. It's really complicated.
Yeah. And it was interesting to see how that dovetailed into, you know, obviously America has had its own day of reckoning with those right. issues lately. And, you know, especially the Bucks with their protests last during the bubble and, you know, George Floyd, Jacob Blake, all of those, seeing how that, you know, Giannis's experiences in Greece as a young kid and now seeing, oh, this is not just exclusive to me as an immigrant in Greece. This is just a problem everywhere. That I just thought you did a really good job of, you know, kind of building and building and building. So now we can see, we get to what August 2020, and now we understand where he's coming from in that regard.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes there's a tendency in media to say so-and-so like overcame racism or triumphed over, you know, and it's like, that's not a thing. It's again, it's a fairy tale narrative that glosses over the harsh realities of racism, which is that no fame can shield you from it. It's everywhere. It's ingrained, embedded into every society all over the world. And Giannis is not immune to that. And I think it also, you know, it's interesting because I think there's parallel themes of masculinity and fatherhood and sons. And of course, him, you know, ending the book on his son, he kind of tied that all up. He's like, at these protests, he was like, I don't want my son to grow up in an environment where this is going to happen. And he has to be afraid and all of these things. And so I think that the story of Giannis just has so many tendrils. It's fascinating. He gets drafted to a city like Milwaukee that is notoriously segregated. He learns about race in America through teammates that have been racially profiled in this city, that have been turned away from restaurants or called the police on when they went to jewelry shops. So, you know, we're contending with all of these things at once. And it's just important to remember that Giannis is 26 years old and he is a young person grappling with geography and identity and basketball and family. And there's a lot of things going on. I'm for one, am genuinely shocked this book was not 700 pages.
I was going to ask, when do we get the sequel? Because it does, you know, right. Obviously there's still plenty to explore with him. And as you said, right. He's only 26. Like we have, we're, it's great to see, you know, this documents like his upcoming into what he is now, but the story on Giannis, I thought, you know, we were talking about this more during the playoffs where like every single game during these past playoffs was like, oh, well, this is a legacy game. Like, oh, right. Game five of the next series is a legacy game. It's like, no, it's not. It's kind of, you know, LeBron had some games early in his career where it's like, he didn't do so well or he did. And his legacy is fine because he's still got 10 years plus in his career.
God, I would wake up on game day for the Bucks and be nervous, like I was suiting up or something. I just felt like there was so much on the line, you know. It's like, oh, this is the game, and I was like, oh, is it though? You know. And it's again, like there's so much to go, and I know that some people are like, well, why'd you write a book on such a young person? And you know, normally books are written about retired people, but I just, you know, from work at Bleacher Report, like, I just find it really interesting talking to fellow young people. Like, I just think they have a lot to say. It's very interesting to catch them in this moment, this time period, right now, before they have the distance to maybe remember things differently or portray things, frame things differently. That often happens when you go back and do a book, there's a gauze over it, you know, or maybe you just matured and see things differently. So I just think, It was awesome to do such a challenging book because it is in real time. so many people were afraid of talking because they didn't want to look like they were tampering. You know, he was in the midst of his Supermax. So yes, it was really, really hard. But I think that he's lived like 8 different lives, and that made a fruitful book.
Yeah.
He's 26, yeah. But he's really 40, basically.
Right. Yeah. I'm so glad that Brian actually brought that up as well, because that was always in the back of my mind when reading about his childhood and all these things. It felt like you went through like just a life in the first couple chapters, really. I mean, so many things happen. And then like I keep going back to like, was he 26? Like, he's 26, right? And it feels right. Like that's almost unrealistic. I remember being 26 myself. I was very wide-eyed, not near anything near, you know, the emotional maturity of Giannis at that age. It's so wild to think of just the obstacles that's been in his way and how much he's had to overcome in such a young age. I mean, has he ever truly been young? I mean, I don't think he's ever had that opportunity, really.
Yeah, that's a great point. No, I don't think so, because, you know, I found the scenes really harrowing when the brothers were describing to me of them getting evicted, and Giannis would have to explain to them, okay, we're leaving, you need to pack your stuff, don't get emotional, blah, blah, blah. He's saying that at age 13, you know, he had to grow up really, really fast. And so there's always been this maturity to him. That's why when during the playoffs, you know, he had that wonderful quote about ego and humility. And, you know, it was like watching people witness fall. It was like I was watching people fall in love with Giannis for the first time. It was very reminiscent of 2013 to 14 when he first came on the scene. Yeah, 2013 to 14. And, everyone's like, how do you get so wise? Oh my God, he just seems so smart and so mature and amazing and wow. And again, like, I see those glimmers from childhood of growing up so fast and being so mature and being in a leadership position with his brothers and having to hold in emotion. Like, it's no surprise to me that he's 26 years old saying the most philosophical things I have heard, like, in my entire sports career.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I
mean, and it also, sorry, Brian, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there was that video clip where he's shooting with PJ Tucker.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
PJ Tucker is like, man, like how are you just always so unfazed by failing? I mean,
right.
And, you know, that again, as you said, like that clip made people fall in love with Giannis. And I right. know among Sixers folks, it was like, oh man, Ben Simmons really is so top that. But now having seen the like your book provides 300 pages of like just background info on, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, this explains how he got to that point. Like now this is just so much more context as to like, of course he's not afraid to miss 2 free throws because the guy was starving for years.
Yeah.
Exactly. What is a meme going to do to Giannis? You know, it's surreal. And I'm glad people are seeing this because I think for at least for the first half of his career before, you know, the last couple of years, I would say like around 2016, 2017, 2018 era, really like he was talked about so exclusively in terms of his physicality. Wow, what a freak. Like, oh my God, the way he can jump and leap. And those things are for sure true, right? Like, duh, that's his athleticism is mind bending. But rarely was he given credit for his mental toughness, his, you know, just inner strength, his IQ. Why is Giannis such a great passer? Well, he's really smart. And he sees the game in an interesting way. And he's just very tough mentally. And that's another reason why I wanted to do this book. I was really tired of him being reduced to a physical specimen. It's the mind that separates Giannis. That is why he's so brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the work ethic too comes across
loud and clear
in the book. You know, we always make fun of Jimmy Butler for the 3 a.m. workouts, but like, yeah. You know, Giannis is very much in that same mold, right? It's like this kid just wants to be in a gym 24/7. Like he goes there, you know, as his safe spot, even through some of the tragedies that happened throughout the book, like his father's passing, he goes like, you know, I have to go to the gym. Like that's going to help me take my mind off of it. You know, even as a kid, as he's starving, like, I just love all of the anecdotes about, you know, he's the last one out of the gym. He's like, his teammates are trying to leave, go on a bus. And he's like, no, Giannis is out here just trying to perfect this one move. And he's getting so pissed off at himself because he just can't. And he's like, he just will not accept. He's like, no, I'm not going to leave until I get it.
Right. And then they're like, can you take a shower? This is disgusting. And he's like, absolutely not. I got bigger things at hand.
It's funny to me that when you think about how players today bring up the court as a lab, I almost think for him, the court is life in a way, in a sort of abstract way. That's at least how I read it. I don't know if I'm way off.
It is life. It is. I would describe it as court is a space of community and comfort. I think of the Bucks giving the mom Veronica a key to the gym, and she's in there getting Giannis's rebounds. I think of how this space allows him to connect with his brothers in a way that maybe you might not without the court. I think of the court as a space where he doesn't have to. He doesn't have to be anything he's not. And there's a respect level that he has for this. Like, I love the anecdotes of childhood mopping the floor when nobody's looking.
Yeah.
And adult mopping the floor when nobody's looking. Or, you know, when the video coordinators at the Bucks try to clean it up, he's like, no, I got this. Like, don't do that for me. There's just this respect and the sanctity for this, you know, mere rectangle of hardwood. And it is so much more than that to him. I think his entire life, you know, you try to find deeper themes to connect a book with or a long form. I think his entire life, he's been searching for home, for belonging, for a space to call his own. And I think that when he's on the court, he has that, you know, and that transcends geography, identity, all those things. So I think, like, the fact that he slept in the gyms in Sapolia and in Milwaukee, again, this is so much more than a basketball court.
So you're saying Giannis probably has a coaching career ahead of him when he's done playing.
Oh my God, that, or just a politician or some kind of ambassador that is involved in the game. Like, I just really see him as, like, you know, the NBA is doing so much internationally with the basketball league in Africa. And I just, like, I'm so curious, like, if he will be tied to that. What, you know, the global academies in Australia, the NBA has poured so much money into India. Like, I just think that Giannis could have such a major act number two after this is all over. And I'm just so fascinated to see what that will be. Again, I got to wait 10 years, but, like, I think that will be so
great. and maybe even more than 10. I mean, the way just looking at him playing now, I mean, my God, he's going to last until he's 40. It seems like that length isn't going anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing because he always looks gassed and yet he pushes through. But, like, oh my God, he always looks so exhausted. And that's because he's giving everything in his entire being to every possession. You know, I've never seen somebody compete as hard as Giannis competes.
Yeah. So I want to ask, you know, not just with this book, but in your work in general, but especially with this book, how hard is it to separate yourselves from your subjects that you're profiling? Or do you end up developing kind of a connection to these people? Like, you know, you mentioned earlier for the Bucks playoff games, like, you woke up nervous during, you know, during this playoff run. Like, do you find yourself not necessarily, like, becoming a Bucks fan, but, you know, wanting these people to go on to have success?
Yes, I got to admit, I'm unbiased. I'm as old school as they come. I'm like, don't let your subject buy you a coffee, you know, old school. We're not going to tag them on Twitter. We're not going to be their friend. Like, I'm very, very old school journalist, but I'm a softie and I feel just so connect, you know, when you get that deep with your subjects and their stories, you understand. You don't know them. I'm not saying I know them, that it takes years to know someone, but I know their deepest, darkest trauma and pain. And that, of course, as a human, I feel somehow connected to that. When I see LaMelo Ball thriving, you know, I feel something and I can't help that. I'm not a robot. I'm like, wow, you know, like, good for you, LaMelo. You know, like, I'm just like, wow. And I, you know, I just look back like, oh my God, remember when he was just a 15-year-old and you met him, you know? So I of course I feel really happy for them. But I also, I don't know if this is me or what, or my own shit, but I gravitate towards people that have really strong work ethics and that are really passionate about what they do. Or have overcome something. I think that's a theme through all my stories. And I'm like that. Giannis in his lab is me with all these books you see behind me. I am a grinder to the core. I take pride in my work. I really love this in the way that he loves his work. And I feel like I've gone through so much in my life and my career. And so I just, it's created an empathy in me and a compassion in me for people that have been on the outside looking in, that who have also gone through struggle. And so, yeah, I do feel connected to my subjects in that way of just being a empathetic, understanding person. But I think journalism classes really get it wrong when they try to stop you from feeling what you feel, because at the end of the day, like, we're human beings. And when you're a feature writer, there's a really strange intimacy that you get with your subjects that is not afforded to you in any other place, in any other avenue in life, meeting a friend, a date, whatever. And you can't help but feel something. But you know, as a person that, you know, has done this for some years now, you know how to separate yourself in terms of writing and reporting, and knowing that the person, as much as you can like them or admire them, like, they're not a saint, and their flaws actually make them very relatable and real. And my job is to not make somebody look good. It's to present their story. Like, I always tell the goal for me with everything I do, I aspire to, and I'm not saying I do this, but I aspire to make, to tell someone's story accurately, truthfully, and beautifully. Those are my three. And I never finish and like, whoa, I just did that, you know, but like, that's my goal. That's what I'm aiming for.
Yeah. I feel like I'm the one who can always tell you afterward that you did it. You definitely did it in this
young. Thanks, Brian. Yeah,
of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, like, you and I have worked together for years, and I am sad that we don't get to as much anymore, but like, I could not imagine a better person to have written this book than you, because of the complexity and, as Mort said, the layers to Giannis's life. Like, you can write just a pure basketball book, right, or you can just encapsulate everything, and you encapsulated everything. And I think that provides more flavor to the basketball stuff. But I want to ask, how difficult was it to kind of strike that balance between, you know, here is the details about Giannis's upbringing, but then we do have to get to, he gets drafted, and how he, you know, goes from this super raw prospect that no one knows anything about to, you know, MVP caliber player.
God, it was so hard. And I, of course, like, you know, I'm nervous writing my first book. I'm thinking of all the potential criticisms that I'm going to get. And one thing I just kept, what if they think that there's not enough basketball, you know, this like anti-Mirren mob that is like out there that doesn't exist, you know, everyone's like really nice to me. And I think there's a like a anti-Mirren mob ready to be like, you didn't have enough basketball. And so I just like had this like, oh my God, what if I don't have enough basketball? And I would just be, you know, I'd wake up and be like, do you have the first Celtics series? Oh my God, there were two, right? And then I like would have to like write down in my notepad, don't forget this. And you know, it's just something that I just kept thinking, because even though like the first half of my life, just my personal life, was dedicated to basketball. I was a basketball player. I was not a writer. Then I became a writer, and writing was more of my love than basketball. And so now I just gravitate more towards the human. And so sometimes in my interviews, I'll be like, oh shit, like I forgot to ask you about basketball. And so it's just this running joke I have with myself, like, don't forget to ask about the sport. And it's like, LOL, you're a sports writer. But you know, it's a balance that I had to like really try hard to strike, because you're right, this book could have written totally in terms of just basketball. And I think that basketball is super interesting. But for me, I felt like the other stuff was more interesting, but I could see people pointing holes in it if I didn't include both. So like the Hawk stuff, very important to me to like double, triple report that to get like the secret meeting in Italy that people don't know about, or like the Spanish coach that signed Giannis. Nobody knows about him, or, you know, all of these things like deromanticizing finding Giannis. I think everyone's like, oh, the Bucks, they knew. And, you know, and oh, we like Giannis. We knew Giannis. And it's like, nobody knew. And actually nobody thought he was good. And actually John Hammond, the Bucks GM, was like, look, I'm not going to make it more than it is. So I think there was just a healthy dose of demystifying the basketball side of things, because it was not this like road that was meant for Giannis. So yeah, I just really pushed myself to include more. The really hard part was getting people to talk, because a lot of PR people, unfortunately, normally you can just go into a locker room and go up to players and they don't care. But when you're in the era of COVID and everything is done digitally, it has to go through all these PR people, and they're afraid of tampering. And, you know, I'm like, no, trust me, I only want to talk about 2014. It's not going to be tampering. I'm not going to ask about anything current. And they're like, no, we can't take the chance. So that was super frustrating. That was hard.
That's interesting. Well, I know our mutual friend and friend of the podcast, Adam Frommel, helped fact check on the book.
Adam!
So
I love Adam.
For the Hawks part in particular, did you know you were going to kill him when he read that part? Or was that a surprise after that?
Okay, first of all, if anyone has a book that they would like fact checked, contact Adam Frommel. This guy is amazing. And, you know, Brian and I worked with him at BR for a long time. Great, great human. Great, great job on the book. I'm so grateful for his work on this book. But yes, he, in the Google Doc for our stuff, he was like, are you trying to kill me like this? And he was like, wow, you know, you got me rooting for the Bucks and not the Hawks. Yeah. Like, who are you? You know? And we were just joking, like, you know, I think the book should come with a trigger warning for Hawks fans. Because, you know, it was written way before the series and all this stuff, you know, and you got the Nate McMillan, you know, yeah. Giannis thinks that Nate was embarrassing him at the Rising Stars challenge in 2014. And he's like, I'm going to make him pay for this. And of course, looking back now, that makes sense. But yeah, it's so funny. I found the Hawks thing to be really interesting, because I was like, okay, did they really want him, or is this revisionist history? Because I do think there's been a lot of mythologizing the thing. And, you know, for example, the Mavericks saying, like, we wanted Giannis. It's like, did you, you know, how, I think there's a lot of revisionist history when it comes to the draft. Like, there's so many players on a draft board, and there's so many guys in the draft room. And if one person raises their hand and says, what about Giannis? And then years later, that turns into, he was our guy. That is not true, right? You know, and a lot of names are thrown out. And so it was important to like really vet the Hawks thing. And it took me like forever to get Danny Ferry, the former Hawks GM, to get on the record. So when that happened, I did a very happy dance in my apartment.
Well, that was a great basketball detail that I don't remember seeing reported before this book. And my condolences to Adam. But I felt the same way reading this. Like, you have me now rooting for the Bucks. And for Giannis, like, I want them to win the next couple championships. I want him to win multiple MVPs now. And I shouldn't, because, you know, I'm a Sixers guy, and like, they're in theory one of the top competitors. But having now allegedly top contender. But, you know, having now seen what Giannis came from, what he overcame to get to the point that he is, it's like, I'm just so genuinely delighted for him, for that, you know, for how this playoff run unfolded. And, you know, how were you processing this, knowing you have this Giannis book coming out and seeing, like, you know, the door is wide open at a certain point after they, you know, when you start the playoffs, they were catching heat because they drew the Heat in the first round. Like, they could have tanked their way out of it. They didn't, and they embraced the challenge. And then get the Nets in the second round, and everyone thinks, oh, they're down 2-0, they're dead. And after that, I was like, oh, all of a sudden, we have this might be our best ever chance to win this championship. So, yeah, how did you handle, all of that?
The emotional roller coaster that I have been on for the past 7 weeks is insane, okay? Like, I was just again, I woke up, it's game day. I'm like, what are you do? Like, who are you? Like, I haven't felt that way about a team. And I'm a Lakers fan growing up, you know, it's been a minute. Like, I don't feel that way normally. I just go about my life, do my job. But I was so locked in, and everyone in my life became a Bucks fan because they were supporting me. And I was rooting for the Bucks because, of course, I was rooting for me. If you don't root for yourself, who's going to root for you? You know, I was like, if they win, I win, you know, and it's like, it just became, you know, something that, you know, first of all, I was just proud to finish the book. It was so hard. This was the hardest year ever, pandemic, all this stuff. But then it was like, wait, the Bucks are doing well in the playoffs and they might legit win. And then everyone's like, oh my God, this could change your life. This could, you know, do all these things for you personally. So I was, then I just became super invested, like, oh my God. And, you know, it's just, it was so crazy. And my family and I, we had a superstition. If we didn't wear our Bucks shirts, you know, they would lose. And, you know, we all got Bucks t-shirts. And, you know, my parents are like 10 minutes away. So, you know, one day I forgot my shirt. It was in the washer over here. And they were like, they're going to lose. It's your fault. And so, you know, I became very involved. And then, of course, when they won, then my life just sped up so much personally with, you know, media and stuff for the promotion. So, and I've never, I'm not used to that. So it's all been a big adjustment.
So when should we expect the epilogue for the Bucks championship run? Or is that a separate book? Do we get a part two coming?
The epilogue is due very soon. I'm just looking at my calendar like, oh Jesus. Yes, it is. The epilogue will be in the paperback, which should be March/spring 2022.
Nice.
So I'm trying to figure out that right now. Yes, thanks for the reminder. And I definitely want, I don't know if I would ever do a part two Giannis book. I don't know, maybe in 10 years, but I'm definitely like, well, what's book number two now? And I'm like rummaging through ideas. I texted Adam, what do you think? And because now I've like imprisoned him for any book I'm gonna do. Like, I'm like, you're stuck with me.
He immediately pitched Trae Young, I assume.
Yes. Yeah. You know, he was like, that doesn't surprise. Well, everyone is asking me, can you write about my favorite player? Because then we can win the championship. And I'm like, you guys, I literally turned this in March 1st, 2021. Goodbye.
I was about to ask the same for Joel Embiid, but I guess
right.
Well, I mean, so yeah, and I was about to ask about Luka, because here's the thing. I think you do so well when it comes to these international prospects as well, because it's one thing, we kind of know the framework when it's in the US, like it's the AAU circuit, high school, college. Like, there's a pretty clear pathway in that regard. Whereas with the international prospects, the road is a little bit more banged up. There are more pathways you can follow. So hopefully one day, I'm whatever you choose to write about, I'll read it. But I would absolutely love, like Brian said, a book on Joel Embiid or Luka Doncic or some of the international guys, because you have such a talent for just creating this world. Again, I'm still mesmerized that you were not in Athens, that you were not in Greece for several months. I mean, that blew my mind that you did all this over Zoom.
Thank you for saying that. That feels like a vindication for all the days I woke up like, oh my God, this book is going to be so bad. I can't be there. So I appreciate it. I've been trying to profile Luca for quite some time now. The request has been out. So maybe this good energy from this podcast will manifest it.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, but I don't think Dallas will let me near them now. But I definitely would love to do that Luca profile, because he's fascinating.
that actually does remind me. I wanted to ask a couple basketball questions, and let's start with Jason Kidd, because you published the excerpt from the book on The Ringer, and I feel like that just lit the internet on fire for 2 days. what were your impressions of Kidd, having seen how it went in Milwaukee, and now what do you kind of expect from the Mavericks?
Yeah, I was very surprised at that took off the way that it did. You know, somebody just aggregated such a small part in a 400 page book. But I think Kidd, you know, is important to talk about it because obviously he played a key role in Giannis's development. And I think, you know, as the book tries to show the complexity of Jason Kidd, and the reporting I did shows a really complicated figure. On the one hand, he correctly identified that Giannis could be, you know, this new school type of big man who has the ball in his hands and he goes straight to the basket. I think Jason was right in assessing that Giannis shouldn't really be taking threes. But at the same time, the way that Jason operated was really maniacal and toxic, and it hurt a lot of people, and it was really manipulative. And yeah, I just thought it was important to show that context. You know, I don't think the book would be fair if it didn't have both the positive and the negative there. I have no idea how it'll work with the Mavericks. You know, it's a different situation. Giannis was younger in his career when this occurred. I don't know if he operates the same way. You know, when I wrote this and reported this, he was not in head coach consideration anywhere. So it's the only reason it went, you know, viral is because he just got hired and then this one guy aggregated this. So yeah, I don't know how it'll go.
Yeah, it was certainly fascinating, and like made me remember Larry Sanders, who I just have not thought about for a couple of years. And it was just like heartbreaking to see how he influenced that. My last question for you. You know, he goes from Jason Kidd to Mike Budenholzer, who came under a lot of criticism in the playoffs over the last couple of years. You know, I thought your book did a really good job of kind of humanizing him as well and showing like how he rose from, you know, kind of anonymity to Bucks head coach and how he developed into that. So, you know, what did you think as you were watching, you know, the last couple of years unfold, really seeing all this criticism of Bud? You know, how did that line up with what you were seeing behind the scenes as you were talking to all the Bucks players and coaches and all that stuff?
Well, it was just fascinating to see that, like, you know, Jason and Bud completely different. Jason would run Giannis ragged. Like he looked so like he couldn't even stand up during some playoff games. And, you know, Bud is sitting Giannis and I'm like, why can't you put him in there? Is there something we don't know? Is there an issue with Giannis's conditioning? Like, what is it? Is it injury stuff we don't know about? I think that people were very touchy about Bud. There were a lot of off the record conversations. You know, as I was watching these playoffs, I was like, okay, well, if they lose, Bud's gone. And that's going to be awkward in the book because there's positive things in there about him. And I think he did relate to Giannis from his own upbringing. But I just think that Bud did adjust appropriately in these playoffs at the end, towards the end. And I think it was interesting to see even the most staunch fire Bud people be like, okay, like we, you know, the job. And I was just monitoring it very closely again. Like it would be so awkward if they fired him, and the book basically ends with like, let's do it. Let's win this thing. And I just kept telling myself, you can't control this. You are not the basketball crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen. I hope the book stands on its own.
It definitely does. And luckily they did win the championship, but just got a 3-year extension. So all worked out. Miren, thank you again for joining us today. This was so much fun to have you. We would love to have you back sometime. You don't have to write another book before you come back, I promise.
Oh, I'd love to come back anytime. You guys are both great. Thank you so much for having me. This was a ton of fun.
Of course. And one more time for our listeners, can you let them know where they can find you on Twitter, where they can find the book, and any other work that you have coming up?
Yes, it's just Miren Fader on Twitter. And then my website, which I worked really, really hard to put together. If you can humor me and go visit it, it's mirenfader.com. You can find the book anywhere. I, again, encourage you to support local as much as you can. My faves are Skylight, Chevaliers, and Romans, which all have signed copies. And I do have some features coming up for The Ringer. Switching over to football a bit, you know, seasons are changing. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm actually taking a vacation next week. I can't believe it. I know it's been so long. So after that, you know, back to the lab as always.
Well, enjoy the much deserved time off. Yes. We're so thrilled for that. This all worked out for you, and I will start bullying you in your DMs to write about Joel Embiid.
Bully me, please. Just keep the request coming, okay?
All right. Well, thank you all, as always, for listening to us. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. And please, we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek. I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen and by our special guest, the New York Times bestselling author, Aaron Fader. Have a good one, you guys.
You too, Brian.